Some plague? Some monster?
Haviland Tuff held up his hand. Patience. First, I must be certain. You have mocked me and derided me with such unflagging vigor that I hesitate to open myself to further ridicule by confiding my plans to you. I shall prove them valid first. Now, let us discuss tomorrow. You shall fly no war run with the Manticore. Instead, I would have you take it to New Atlantis and convene a full meeting of the Council of Guardians. Fetch those who require fetching from outlying islands, please.
And you?
Kafirakwe asked. I shall meet with the Council when it is time. Prior to that, I shall take my plans and my creature to Namor on a mission of our own. We shall descend in the Phoenix, I believe. Yes, I do think the Phoenix most appropriate to commemorate your world rising from its ashes. Markedly wet ashes, but ashes nonetheless. Kafirakwe met Haviland Tuff on the shuttle deck just prior to their scheduled departure. Manticore and Phoenix stood ready in their launch berths amidst the scatter of derelict spacecraft. Haviland Tuff was punching numbers into a mini-computer strapped to the inside of his wrist. He wore a long gray vinyl greatcoat with copious pockets and flaring shoulder boards, a green and brown duck-billed cap, decorated with the golden theta of the ecological engineers, perched rakishly atop his bald head.
I have notified Namor Control and Guardian Headquarters, Quay said. The Council is assembling. I will provide transportation for a half-dozen Lords Guardian from outlying districts, so all of them will be on hand. How about you, Tuff? Are you ready? Is your mystery creature on board?
Soon, said Haviland Tuff, blinking at her. But Kafirakwe was not looking at his face. Her gaze had gone lower.
Tuff, she said. There is something in your pocket, moving.
Incredulous, she watched the ripple creep along beneath the vinyl.
Bah,
said Tuff, indeed. And then the head emerged from his pocket and peered about curiously. It belonged to a kitten, a tiny jet-black kitten with lambent yellow eyes.
A cat,
muttered Kafirakwe sourly. Your perception is uncanny, said Haviland Tuff. He lifted the kitten out gently and held it cupped in one great white hand, while scratching behind its ear with a finger from the other. This is Dax, he said solemnly. Dax was scarcely half the size of the older kittens who frisked about the Ark. He looked like nothing but a ball of black fur, curiously limp and indolent.
Wonderful,
the Guardian replied.
Dax, eh? Where did this one come from? No, don't answer that. I can guess. Tuff, don't we have more important things to do than play with cats?
I think not, said Haviland Tuff. You do not appreciate cats sufficiently, Guardian. They are the most civilized of creatures. No world can be considered truly cultured without cats. Are you aware that all cats, from time immemorial, have had a touch of psi? Do you know that some ancient societies of old Earth worshipped cats as gods? It is true.
Please,
said Kafirakwe irritably.
We don't have time for a discourse on cats. Are you going to bring that poor little thing down to Namor with you?
Tuff blinked. Indeed, this poor little thing, as you so contemptuously call him, is the salvation of Namor. Respect might be in order. She stared at him as if he had gone mad.
What? That? Him? I mean Dax? Are you serious? What are you talking about? You're joking, aren't you? This is some kind of insane jest. You've got some thing loaded aboard the Phoenix, some huge leviathan that will cleanse the sea of those dreadnoughts. Something. Anything, I don't know. But you can't mean... You can't. Not that.
Him, said Haviland Tuff. Guardian, it is so wearisome to have to state the obvious, not once but again and again. I have given you raveners and krakens and lash-tail mantas at your insistence. They have not been efficacious. Accordingly, I have done much hard thinking, and I have cloned Dax.
A kitten,
she said.
You're going to use a kitten against the dreadnoughts and the fire balloons and the walkers. One small kitten.
Indeed, said Haviland Tuff. He frowned down at her, slid Dax back into the roomy confines of his great pocket. and turned smartly toward the waiting Phoenix. Gefira Quay was growing very nervous. In the council chambers high atop Breakwater Tower on New Atlantis, the 25 Lords Guardian who commanded the defense of all Namor were restive. All of them had been waiting for hours. Some had been there all day. The long conference table was littered with personal communicators and computer printouts and empty water glasses. Two meals had already been served and cleared away. By the wide, curving window that dominated the far wall, portly Lord Guardian Alys was talking in low, urgent tones to Lord Guardian Lysen, thin and stern, and both of them were giving meaningful glances to Gefira Quay from time to time. Behind them, the sun was going down, and the great bay was turning a lovely shade of scarlet. It was such a beautiful scene that one scarcely noticed the small bright dots that were Guardian skimmers flying patrol. Dusk was almost upon them. The council members were grumbling and stirring impatiently in their big cushioned chairs, and Haviland Tuff had still failed to make an appearance.
"When did he say he would be here?" asked Lord Guardian Kem for the fifth time.
"He wasn't very precise, Lord Guardian,"
Gefira Quay replied uneasily for the fifth time. Kem frowned and cleared his throat. Then one of the communicators began to beep, and Lord Guardian Lysen strode over briskly and snatched it up.
"Yes," he said. "I see. Quite good. Escort him in."
He set down the communicator and rapped its edge on the table for order. The others shuffled to their seats, or broke off their conversations, or straightened. The council chamber grew silent.
"That was the patrol. Tuff's shuttle has been sighted. He is on his way, I am pleased to report."
Lysen glanced at Gefira Quay.
"At last."
The Guardian felt even more uneasy then. It was bad enough that Tuff had kept them waiting, but she was dreading the moment when he came lumbering in, Dax peering out of his pocket. Quay had been unable to find the words to tell her superiors that Tuff proposed to save Namor with a small black kitten. She fidgeted in her seat and plucked at her large crooked nose. This was going to be bad, she feared. It was worse than anything she could have dreamed. All of the Lord's Guardian were waiting, stiff and silent and attentive, when the doors opened and Haviland Tuff walked in, escorted by four armed guards in golden coveralls. He was a mess. His boots made a squishing sound as he walked, and his greatcoat was smeared with mud. Dax was visible in his left pocket, all right, paws hooked over its edge and large eyes intent. But the Lord's Guardian weren't looking at the kitten. Beneath his other arm, Haviland Tuff was carrying a muddy rock the size of a big man's head. A thick coating of green-brown slime covered it, and it was dripping water onto the plush carpet. Without so much as a word, Tuff went directly to the conference table and set the rock down in the center of it. That was when Gefira Quay saw the fringe of tentacles, pale and fine as threads, and realized that it wasn't a rock after all.
"A mud pot," she said aloud in surprise.
No wonder she hadn't recognized it. She had seen many a mud pot in her time, but not until after they had been washed and boiled and the tendrils trimmed away. Normally they were served with a hammer and chisel to crack the bony carapace, and a dish of melted butter and spices on the side. The Lord's Guardian looked on in astonishment, and then all 25 began talking at once, and the council chamber became a blur of overlapping voices.
"It is a mud pot. I don't understand.
What is the meaning of this? He makes us wait all day, and then comes to council as filthy as a mud grubber. The dignity of the council is, haven't eaten a mud pot in, oh, 2, 3.
Can't be the man who is supposed to save. Insane. Why, just look at.
What is the thing in his pocket? Look at it. My God, it moved. It's alive, I tell you, I saw it.
Silence.
Lysen's voice was like a knife cutting through the hubbub. The room quieted as, one by one, the Lord's Guardian turned toward him.
"We have come together at your beck and call," Lysen said acidly to Tuff. "We expect you to bring us an answer. Instead, you appear to have brought us dinner."
Someone snickered. Haviland Tuff frowned down at his muddy hands, and wiped them primly on his greatcoat. Taking Dax from his pocket, Tuff deposited the lethargic black kitten on the table. Dax yawned and stretched, and ambled toward the nearest of the Lord's Guardian, who stared in horror and hurriedly inched her chair back a bit. Shrugging out of his wet, muddy greatcoat, Tuff looked about for a place to put it, and finally hung it from the laser rifle of one of his escort. Only then did he turn back to the Lord's Guardian. "Esteemed Lord's Guardian," he said, "this is not dinner you see before you. In that very attitude lies the root of all your problems. This is the ambassador of the race that shares Namor with you, whose name, regrettably, is far beyond my small capabilities. His people will take it quite badly if you eat him." Eventually, someone brought Lysen a gavel, and he rapped it long and loud enough to attract everyone's attention, and the furor slowly ebbed away. Haviland Tuff had stood impassively through all of it, his face without expression, his arms folded against his chest. Only when silence was restored did he say, "Perhaps I should explain."
"You are mad,"
Lord Guardian Harvin said, looking from Tuff to the mud pot and back again.
"Utterly mad."
Haviland Tuff scooped up Dax from the table, cradled him in one arm, and began to pet him. "Even in our moment of victory, we are mocked and insulted," he said to the kitten. "Tuff," said Lysen from the head of the long table, "what you suggest is impossible. We have explored Namor quite sufficiently in the century we have been here, so as to be certain that no sentient races dwell upon it. There are no cities, no roads, no signs of any prior civilization or technology, no ruins or artifacts, nothing, neither above nor below the sea."
"Moreover,"
said another counselor, a beefy woman with a red face,
"the mudpots cannot possibly be sentient." "Agreed. They have brains the size of a human brain, but that is about all they have. They have no eyes, ears, noses, almost no sensory equipment whatever except for touch. They have only those feeble tendrils as manipulative organs, scarcely strong enough to lift a pebble. And in fact, the tendrils are only used to anchor them to their spot on the seabed. They are hermaphroditic and downright primitive, mobile only in the first month of life, before the shell hardens and grows heavy. Once they root on the bottom and cover themselves with mud, they never move again. They stay there for hundreds of years."
"Thousands," said Haviland. "They are remarkably long-lived creatures. All that you say is undoubtedly correct. Nonetheless, your conclusions are in error. You have allowed yourself to be blinded by belligerence and fear. If you had removed yourself from the situation and paused long enough to think about it in depth, as I did, no doubt it would become obvious, even to the military mind, that your plight was no natural catastrophe. Only the machinations of some enemy intelligence could sufficiently explain the tragic course of events on Namor."
"You don't expect us to believe,"
someone began. "Sir," said Haviland Tuff, "I expect you to listen. If you will refrain from interrupting me, I will explain all. Then you may choose to believe or not, as suits your peculiar fancy. I shall take my fee and depart." Tuff looked at Dax. "Idiots, Dax. Everywhere we are beset by idiots." Turning his attention back to the Lord's Guardian, he continued, "As I have stated, intelligence was clearly at work here. The difficulty was in finding that intelligence. I perused the work of your Namorian biologists, living and dead, read much about your flora and fauna, recreated many of the native life forms aboard the Ark. No likely candidate for sentience was immediately forthcoming. The traditional hallmarks of intelligent life include a large brain, sophisticated biological sensors, mobility, and some sort of manipulative organ, such as an opposable thumb. Nowhere on Namor could I find a creature with all of these attributes. My hypothesis, however, was still correct. Therefore, I must needs move on to unlikely candidates, as there were no likely ones. To this end, I studied the history of your plight, and at once some things suggested themselves. You believed that your sea monsters emerged from the dark oceanic depths, but where did they first appear? and the offshore shallows, the areas where you practiced fishing and sea farming. What did all these areas have in common? Certainly an abundance of life, that must be admitted. Yet not the same life. The fish that habituated the waters off New Atlantis did not frequent those of the Broken Hand. Yet I found two interesting exceptions. Two species found virtually everywhere. The mudpots, lying immobile in their great soft beds through the long, slow centuries, and, originally, the things you call Nemurian men of war. The ancient native race has another term for those. They call them guardians. Once I had come this far, it was only a matter of working out the details and confirming my suspicions. I might have arrived at my conclusion much earlier, but for the rude interruptions of Liaison Officer Quay, who continually shattered my concentration and finally, most cruelly, forced me to waste much time sending forth gray krakens and razor wings and sundry other such creatures. In the future, I shall spare myself such liaisons. Yet, in a way, the experiment was useful, since it confirmed my theory as to the true situation on Namor. Accordingly, I pressed on. Geographic studies showed that all of the monsters were thickest near mudpot beds. The heaviest fighting had been in those selfsame areas, my Lord's Guardian. Clearly, these mudpots you find so eminently edible were your mysterious foes. Yet how could that be? These creatures had large brains, to be sure, but lacked all the other traits we have come to associate with sentience as we know it. And that was the very heart of it. Clearly, they were sentient, as we do now know it. What sort of intelligent being could live deep under the sea, immobile, blind, deaf, bereft of all input? I pondered that question. The answer, sirs, is obvious. Such an intelligence must interact with the world in ways we cannot, must have its own modes of sensing and communicating. Such an intelligence must be telepathic. Indeed, the more I considered it, the more obvious it became. Thereupon, it was only a matter of testing my conclusions. To that end, I brought forth Dax. All cats have some small psionic ability, Lord's Guardian. Yet, long centuries ago, in the days of the Great War, the soldiers of the Federal Empire struggled against enemies with terrible psi powers, Frangan minds and Githyanki soul sucks. To combat such formidable foes, the genetic engineers worked with felines, and vastly heightened and sharpened their psionic abilities, so they could ESP in unison with mere humans. Dax is such a special animal.
Do you mean that thing is reading our minds? Lysen said sharply.
Insofar as you have minds to read, said Haviland Tuff. Yes, but more importantly, through Dax, I was able to reach that ancient people you have so ignominiously dubbed mudpots. For they, you see, are entirely telepathic. For millennia beyond counting, they have dwelled in tranquility and peace beneath the seas of this world. They are a slow, thoughtful, philosophic race, and they lived side by side in the billions, each linked with all the others, each an individual, and each a part of the great racial whole. In a sense, they were deathless, for all shared the experiences of each, and the death of one was as nothing. Experiences were few in the unchanging sea, however. For the most part, their long lives are given over to abstract thought, to philosophy, to strange green dreams that neither you nor I can truly comprehend. They are silent musicians, one might say. Together they have woven great symphonies of dreams, and those songs go on and on. Before humanity came to Namor, they had had no real enemies for millions of years. Yet that had not always been the case. In the primordial beginnings of this wet world, the oceans teemed with creatures who relished the taste of the dreamers as much as you do. Even then, the race understood genetics, understood evolution. With their vast web of interwoven minds, they were able to manipulate the very stuff of life itself, more skillfully than any genetic engineers. And so they evolved their guardians, formidable predators with a biological imperative to protect those you call mudpots. These were your men of war. From that time to this, they guarded the beds, while the dreamers went back to their symphony of thought. Then you came, from Aquarius and old Poseidon. Indeed, you did. Lost in the reverie, the dreamers hardly noticed for many years. While you farmed and fished and discovered the taste of mud pots. You must consider the shock you gave them, Lord's Guardian. Each time you plunged one of them into boiling water, all of them shared the sensations. To the dreamers, it seemed as though some terrible new predator had evolved upon the landmass, a place of little interest to them. They had no inkling that you might be sentient, since they could no more conceive of a non-telepathic sentience than you could conceive of one blind, deaf, immobile, and edible. To them, things that moved and manipulated and ate flesh were animals, and could be nothing else. The rest you know, or can surmise. The dreamers are a slow people, lost in their vast songs, and they were slow to respond. First, they simply ignored you, in the belief that the ecosystem itself would shortly check your ravages. This did not appear to happen. To them, it seemed you had no natural enemies. You bred and expanded constantly, and many thousands of minds fell silent. Finally, they returned to the ancient, almost forgotten ways of their dim past, and woke to protect themselves. They sped up the reproduction of their guardians, until the seas above their beds teemed with their protectors. But the creatures that had once sufficed admirably against other enemies proved to be no match for you. Finally, they were driven to new measures. Their minds broke off the great symphony and ranged out, and they sensed and understood. At last, they began to fashion new guardians, guardians formidable enough to protect them against this great new nemesis. Thus it went. When I arrived upon the Ark, and Kephira Quay forced me to unleash many new threats to their peaceful dominion, the dreamers were initially taken aback. But the struggle had sharpened them, and they responded more quickly now. And in only a very short time they were dreaming newer guardians still, and sending them forth to battle to oppose the creatures I had loosed upon them. Even as I speak to you in this most imposing tower of yours, many a terrible new life form is stirring beneath the waves, and soon will emerge to trouble your sleep in years to come. Unless, of course, you come to a peace. That is entirely your decision. I am only a humble ecological engineer. I would not dream of dictating such matters to the likes of you. Yet, I do suggest it in the strongest possible terms. So here is the ambassador plucked from the sea, at great personal discomfort to myself, I might add. The dreamers are now in much turmoil, for when they felt Dax among them, and through them touched me, their world increased a millionfold. They learned of the stars today, and learned moreover that they are not alone in this cosmos. I believe they will be reasonable, as they have no use for the land, nor any taste for fish. Here is Dax as well, and myself. Perhaps we might commence to talk. But when Haviland Tuff fell silent at last, no one spoke for quite a long time. The Lord's Guardian were all ashen and numb. One by one they looked away from Tuff's impassive features to the muddy shell on the table. Finally, Kephira Quay found her voice.
"What do they want?"
she asked nervously.
"Chiefly," said Haviland Tuff, "they want you to stop eating them. This strikes me as an eminently sensible proposal. What is your reply?"
2 million standards is insufficient," Haviland Tuff said some time later, sitting in the communications room of the Ark. Dax rested calmly in his lap, having little of the frenetic energy of the other kittens. Elsewhere in the room, suspicion and hostility were chasing each other hither and yon. Up on the telescreen, Kephira Quay's features broke into a suspicious scowl.
"What do you mean? This was the price we agreed upon, Tuff. If you are trying to cheat us..."
"Cheat?" Tuff sighed.
"Did you hear her, Dax?
After all we have done, such grim accusations are still flung at us willy-nilly." "Yes, willy-nilly indeed. An odd phrase when one stops to mull on it." He looked back at the telescreen. "Guardian Quay, I am fully aware of the agreed-on price. For 2 million standards, I solved your difficulties. I analyzed and pondered and provided the insight and the translator you so sorely needed. I have even left you with 25 telepathic cats, each linked to one of your Lord's Guardian, to facilitate further communications after my departure. That, too, is included within the terms of our initial agreement, since it was necessary to the solution of your problem, and being at heart more a philanthropist than a businessman, and deeply sentimental as well. I have even allowed you to retain Foolishness, who took a liking to you for some reason that I am entirely unable to fathom. For that, too, there is no charge.
Then why are you demanding an additional 3 million standards?
Demanded Kefira Quay. For unnecessary work which I was cruelly compelled to do, Tuff replied. Would you care for an itemized accounting?
Yes, I would,
she said. Very well. For sharks, for barracuda, for giant squid, for orcas, for gray kraken, for blue kraken, for bloodlace, for water jellies, 20,000 standards per item. For fortress fish, 50,000 standards. For the weed that weeps and whispers, 8. He went on for a long, long time. When he was done, Kefira Quay set her lips sternly.
I will submit your bill to the Council of Guardians, she said. But I will tell you straight out that your demands are unfair and exorbitant, and our balance of trade is not sufficient to allow for such an overflow of hard standards. You can wait in orbit for 100 years, Tuff, but you won't get any 5 million standards.
Haviland Tuff raised his hands in surrender. Ah, he said. So because of my trusting nature, I must take a loss. I will not be paid, then.
2 million standards, said the Guardian, as we agreed.
I suppose I might accept this cruel and unethical decision and take it as one of life's hard lessons. Very well, then. So be it. He stroked Dax. It has been said that those who do not learn from history are doomed to repeat it. I can only blame myself for this wretched turn of events. Why, it was only a few scant months past that I chanced to view a historical drama on this very sort of situation. It was about a seed ship, such as my own, that rid one small world of an annoying pest, only to have the ungrateful planetary government refuse payment. Had I been wiser, that would have taught me to demand my payment in advance. He sighed. But I was not wise, and now I must suffer. Tuff stroked Dax again, and paused. Perhaps your Council of Guardians might be interested in viewing this particular tape, purely for recreational purposes. It is holographic, fully dramatized, and well acted. And moreover, it gives a fascinating insight into the workings and capabilities of a ship such as this one. Highly educational. The title is Seed Ship of Hamelin. They paid him, of course. Life regarded as a jigsaw puzzle of highly lustrous cats. Michael Bishop.
Michael Bishop has been publishing stories, novels, poetry, and criticism for 40 years, starting at age 2. His novel, No Enemy But Time, won the Nebula Award. Unicorn Mountain won the Mythopoeic Fantasy Award. And Brittle Innings won the Locus Award for Best Fantasy Novel. He has published 7 volumes of short fiction, and his stories have won the Nebula, 2 Southeastern Science Fiction Association Short Fiction Awards, and, most recently, the Shirley Jackson Award for Best Short Story, The Pile, based on notes left behind by his late son, Jamie. His most recent book, this time as editor, is the anthology A Cross of Centuries, 25 Imaginative Tales About the Christ. And his most recent story is a Lovecraftian science fiction tale, The City Quiet as Death, written with Stephen Utley and published at TOR.com. Bishop says that he borrowed one image in the story from Annie Dillard's Pilgrim at Tinker Creek, a passage in which she describes a cat of hers walking across her bed and unclothed body, leaving rose-like red paw prints behind as a result of having earlier stalked through red wet clay.
Your father-in-law, who insists that you call him Howie, even though you prefer Mr. Bragg, likes jigsaw puzzles. If they prove harder than he has the skill or the patience for, he knows a sneaky way around the problem. During the third Christmas season after your marriage to Marty, you find Howie at a card table wearing a parka, a blue watch cap with a crown of burgundy leather, and fur-lined shoes. December through February, it is freezing in the Bragg's Tudor-style house outside Spartanburg. He is assembling a huge jigsaw puzzle, for the Braggs give him one every Christmas. His challenge is to put it together, unaided by drop-in company or any other family member, before the Sugar Bowl kickoff on New Year's Day. This year, the puzzle is of cats. The ESP procedure being administered to you by the zoo cop and his associates is keyed to cats. When they zap your implanted electrodes, cat-related memories parachute into your mind's eye, opening out like fireworks. The lid from the puzzle's box is Mr. Bragg's, Howie's, blueprint, and it depicts a population explosion of stylized cats. They are both mysterious beasts and whimsical cartoons. The puzzle lacks any background, it's so full of cats. They run, stalk, lap milk, tussle, tongue-file their fur, snooze, etc., etc. There are no puzzle areas where a single color dominates, a serious obstacle to quick assembly. Howie has a solution. When only a handful of pieces remain in the box, he uses a razor blade to shave any piece that refuses to fit where he wants it to. This is cheating, as even Howie readily acknowledges. But on New Year's Eve, with Dick Clark standing in Times Square and the Sugar Bowl game only hours away, a man can't afford to screw around. "Looking good," you say as the crowd on TV starts its rowdy countdown to midnight. "You're almost there." Howie confesses, complains, that this puzzle has been a real mind-bender. He appreciates the challenge of 1,000-plus pieces and a crazy-making dearth of internal clues. But why this particular puzzle? He usually receives a photographic landscape or a Western painting by Remington.
"I'm not a cat fancier," he tells you. "Most of them are sneaky little bastards, don't you think?"
Marty likes cats, but when you get canned at Piedmont Freight in Atlanta, she moves back to Spartanburg with your son, Jacob, who may be allergic to cats. Marty leaves in your keeping two calico mongrels that duck out of sight whenever you try to feed or catch them. You catch them eventually, of course, and drive them to the pound in a plastic animal carrier that Marty bought from Delta, or Eastern, or some other airline out at Hartsfield. Pinfield, a.k.a. the zoo cop, wants to know how you lost your job. He gives you a multiple-choice quiz. A. Company-wide layoff. B. Neglect of duty and or unacceptable job performance. C. Personality conflict with a supervisor. D. Suspicion of disloyalty. E. All or none of the above. You tell him that there was an incident of alleged sexual harassment involving a female secretary whose name, even under the impetus of electrical stimulation of the brain, ESB, you cannot now recall. All you can recall is every cat, real or imaginary, ever to etch its image into your consciousness. After your firing, you take the cats, Springer and Ossie, short for Ocelot, to the pound. When you look back from the shelter's doorway, a teenage attendant is giving you, no doubt about it, the evil eye. Springer and Ossie are doomed. No one in the big, busy city wants a mixed-breed female. The fate awaiting 9-year-old Jacob's cats, never mind their complicity in his frightening asthma, is the gas chamber. But today, you are as indifferent to the cat's fate as a latter-day Eichmann. You are numb from the molecular level upward. "We did have them spayed," you defend yourself. "Couldn't you use that to pitch them to some nice family?" You begin to laugh. Is this another instance of inappropriate affect? Except for the laughing gas given to you to sink the electrodes, you've now been off all medication for you don't know how long. On the street only 3 years after your dismissal, you wept at hobos' bawdy jokes, got up and danced if the obituaries you'd been sleeping under reported an old friend's death. Once, you giggled when a black girl bummed a cigarette in the parking lot of Trinity United Methodist.
I got AIDS, man. Ain't no smoke gonna kill me. Ain't time enough for the old lung seed to kick in, too.
Now that Penfield's taken you off antipsychotics, is ye old inappropriate affect kicking in again? Or is this fallout from the ESB? After all, one gets entirely different responses, rage and affection, fear and bravado, from zapping hypothalamic points less than 0.02 inches from each other. Spill it, Adolf, Penfield says. What's so funny? Cat juggling, you tell him. Your name has never been Adolf. What? Steve Martin in The Jerk. An illegal Mexican sport. A joke, you know. Cat juggling. You surrender to jerky laughter. It hurts, but your glee isn't appropriate. The movie was a comedy. People were supposed to laugh. Forget that when you close your eyes, you see yourself as the outlaw juggler. Forget that the cats in their caterwauling orbits include Springer, Ossie, Ty-Ty, Romeo, and an anonymous albino kitten from your dead grandparents' grain crib on their farm outside Montgomery. As a boy in Hapeville, the cat you like best is Ty-Ty, a male Siamese that your mama and you inherit from the family moving out. His name isn't Ty-Ty before your mama starts calling him that, though. It's something fake Chinese like Lung Si or Mauser Tongue. The folks moving out don't want to take him with them. Their daddy's got a job with Otero Steel in Pueblo, Colorado. Besides, Mauser Tongue's not likely to appreciate the ice and snow out there. He's a deep south cat, Dixie born and bred.
You are who you are,
Mama tells a Siamese while he rubs her laddered nylons.
But from here on out, your name is Ty-Ty.
Why are you calling him that?
You ask her.
Because it fits a cracker Siamese, she says.
It's several years later before you realize that Thailand is Siam's current name, and that there's a gnat-plagued town southeast of Albany called, yeah, Ty-Ty. Your mama's a smart gal, with an agile mind and a quirky sense of humor. How Daddy ever got it into his head that she wasn't good enough for him is a mystery. It's her agile mind and her quirky sense of humor that did her in, the zoo cop says, pinching back your eyelid. Anyway, Daddy ran off to a Florida dog track town with a chunky bottle blonde ex-hairdresser who dropped a few pounds and started a mail-order weight loss tonic business. He's been gone 9 weeks and 4 days. Ty-Ty, when you notice him, is pretty decent company. He sheathes his claws when he's in your lap. He purrs at a bearable register. He eats leftover vegetables, peas, lima beans, spinach, as readily as he does bacon rinds or chicken scraps. A doll, Mama calls him. A gentleman. This ESB business distorts stuff. It flips events, attitudes, preferences upside down. The last shall be first, the first shall be last. This focus on cats, for example, is a major distortion, a misleading re-envisioning of the life that you lived before getting trapped by Rockdale Biological Supply Company. Can't Penfield see this? Uh-uh. No way. He's too hot to screw Rockdale Biological's bigwigs. The guy may have right on his side, but to him, for the moment anyway, you're just another human oven cake. If you crumble when the heat's turned up, great. Zippity-zoo cop, pop me a cold one, justice is served. Thing is, you prefer dogs. Even as a kid, you like them more. You bring home flea-bitten strays and beg to keep them. When you live in Alabama, you covet the liney chow, Simba, that waits every afternoon in the Notasulga schoolyard for Wesley Duplantier. Dogs, not cats. Until Mauser Tongue, Ty-Ty, all the cats you know prowl on the edges of your attention. Even Ty-Ty comes to you and Mama, over here in Georgia, as a kind of offhand housewarming gift. Dogs, Mr. Zoo Cop, not cats. Actually, Penfield says, I'm getting the idea that what was in the forefront of your attention, Adolf, was women. After puberty, your attention never has a forefront. You are dive-bombed by stimuli. Girls' faces are billboards. Their bodies are bigger billboards. jigsawed ad signs, a piece here, a piece there. It isn't just girls. It's everything. Cars, buildings, TV talking heads, mosquito swarms, jet contrails, interchangeable male callers at supper time, battle scenes on the 6 o'clock news, rock idols infinitely glitterized, the whole schmear fragmenting as it feeds into you, Mr. Teenage Black Hole of the Spirit. Except when romancing a sweet young gal, your head's a magnet for all the flack generated by the media-crazed 20th century.
You're tomcatting, aren't you?
Mama says.
You're tomcatting just like Webb did. God.
It's a way to stay focused. With their faces and body under you, they cease to be billboards. You're a human being again, not a radio receiver or a gravity funnel. The act imposes a fleeting order on the ricocheting chaos working every instant to turn you, the mind cementing it all together into a flimsy cardboard box of mismatched pieces.
Is that tomcatting?
Resisting, by a tender union of bodies, the consequences of dumping a jigsaw puzzle of cats into a box of pieces that, assembled, would depict, say, a unit of embattled flat gunners on Corregidor? Christ, the zoo cop says, a more highfalutin excuse for chasing tail I've never heard. Your high school is crawling with cats. Cool cats, punk cats, stray cats, dead cats. Some are human, some aren't. You dissect a cat in biology lab. On a plaster of Paris base, guyed upright by wires, stands the bleached skeleton of a quadruped, Mr. Osteen. He's also the track and girls' softball coach. Swears was a member of Felis catus, the common house cat. With its underlying gauntness exposed and its skull gleaming brittle and grotesque, this skeleton resembles that of something prehistoric. Pamela Van Ryn and two or three other girls want to know where the cats in the lab came from.
A scientific supply house, Coach Osteen says. Same place we get our bullfrogs, our microscope slides, the insects in that there display case.
He nods at it.
Where does the supply house get them?
Pamela says.
I don't know, Pammy. Maybe they raise them. Maybe they round up strays. You missing a kitty?
In fact, rumor holds that Mr. Osteen found the living source of his skeleton behind the track field's south bleachers, chloroformed it, carried it home, and boiled the fur off it in a pot on an old stove in his basement. Because of the smell, his wife spent a week in Augusta with her mother. Rumor holds that cat lovers hereabouts would be wise to keep their pets indoors. Slicing into the chest cavity of the specimen provided by the supply house, you find yourself losing it. You are the only boy in Coach Osteen's lab to contract nausea and an overwhelming uprush of self-disgust. The only boy, clammy-palmed and light-headed, to have to leave the room. The ostensible shame of your departure is lost on Pamela, who agrees in Nurse Mayhew's office to rendezvous with you later that afternoon at the Huddle House.
This is the heart,
you can still hear Osteen saying.
Looks like a wet rubber strawberry, don't it?
As a 7-year-old, you wander into the grain crib of the barn on the Powell farm. A one-eyed mongrel queen named Skye has dropped a litter on the deer hides, today stiff and rat-eaten, that Gramby Powell stowed there 20 or more years ago. Skye one-eyes you with real suspicion, all set to bolt or hiss, as you lean over a rail to study the blind quintet of her kittening. They're not much, mere lumps.
Turds with fur, Gramby called them last night, to Meemaw Anita's scandalized dismay, and the keen amusement of your daddy.
They hardly move. One kitten gleams white on the stiff hide, in the nervous curl of Skye's furry belly. You spit at Skye, as another cat would spit, but louder.
Spit, spit.
So that eventually, intimidated, she gets up, kittens falling from her like bombs from the open bay of a B-52, and slinks to the far wall of the crib. You climb over the rail and pick up the white kitten, the maybe albino, as Meemaw Anita dubbed it.
Won't know for sure, she said, till its eyes are open.
You turn the kitten in your hands. Which end is which? It's sort of hard to say. Okay, Here's the starchy white potato print of its smashed-in pug of a face. Eyes shut, ears a pair of napkin folds, mouth a miniature crimson gap. You rub the helpless critter on your cheek. Cat smells. Hay smells. Hide smells. It's hard not to sneeze. It occurs to you that you could throw this maybe albino like a baseball. You could wind up like Denny McLean and fling it at the far wall of the grain crib. If you aim just right, you might be able to hit the wall so that the kitten rebounds and lands on Sky. You could sing a funny song. Sky's being falling on. Oh, sky's being falling on. What you think about that? And nobody will ever know if poor little maybe albino has pink eyes or not. This sudden impulse horrifies you, even as a kid, especially as a kid. You can see the white kitten dead. Trembling, you set the kitten back down on the cardboardy deer hide, climb back over the crib rail, and stand away from the naked litter while Sky tries to decide what to do next. Unmanfully, you start to cry.
Sorry, kitty. Sorry, Sky. I'm really sorry.
You almost want Gramby or Meemaw and Anita to stumble in on you, in the churchly gloom and itch of their grain crib, to see you doing this heartfelt penance for a foul deed imagined but never carried out. It's okay to cry a bit in front of your mama's folks. I'm touched, Penfield says, but speak up. Stop mumbling. For several months after your senior year, you reside in the adolescent wing of the Quiet Harbor Psychiatric Center in a suburb of Atlanta. You're there to neutralize the disorienting stimuli, flack, you call it, burning out your emotional wiring, flying at you from everywhere. You're there to relearn how to live with no despairing recourse to disguises, sex, drugs. Bad drugs, the doctors mean. At QHPC, they give you good drugs. This is actually the case, not sarcastic bullshit. Kim Yon, one of the psychotherapists in the so-called wild child wing, assures you that this is so, that antipsychotics aren't addictive. You get 20 milligrams a day of haloperidol. You take it in liquid form in paper cups shaped like dollhouse-sized coffee filters.
You're not an addict, Kim says.
Everyone at QHPC calls her Kim.
Think of yourself as a diabetic, of Haldol as insulin. You don't hold a diabetic off insulin. That'd be criminal.
Not only do you get Haldol, you get talk therapy, recreational therapy, family therapy, crafts therapy. Some of the residents of the wild child wing are druggies and sexual abuse victims as young as 12. They get these same therapies, along with pet therapy. The pets brought in on Wednesdays often include cats. At last, Penfield tells an associate, that last jolt wasn't a mishit after all. The idea is that hostile, fearful, or withdrawn kids who don't interact well with other people will do better with animals. Usually they do. Kittens under a year, tumbling with one another, batting at yarn balls, exploring the pet room with their tails up like radio antennas on cars, seem to be effective four-legged therapists. One teenage girl, a manic depressive who calls herself Eagle Rose, goes gaga over them.
Oh,
she says, holding up a squirmy, smoke-colored male and nodding at two kittens wrestling in an empty carton of extra-large Tide.
They're so soft, so neat, so highly lustrous.
Despite Kim Yawn's many attempts to involve you, you stand aloof from everyone. It's Eagle Rose who focuses your attention, not the kittens, and ER is an untouchable. Every patient here is an untouchable that way. It would be a terrible betrayal to think anything else. So, mostly, you don't. The year before you marry, Marty is renting a house on North Highland Avenue. The whole house. It's not a big house, but she has plenty of room. She uses one bedroom as a studio. In this room, on the floor, lies a large canvas on which she has been painting, exclusively in shades of blue, the magnified heart of a magnolia. She calls the painting, too explicitly, you think, Magnolia Heart in Blue. She's worked on it all quarter. often appraising it from a stepladder to determine how best to continue. Every weekend, you sleep with Marty in the bedroom next to the studio. Her mattress rests on the floor, without box springs or bedstead. You sometimes feel that you're lying in the middle of a painting in progress, a strange but gratifying sensation that you may or may not carry into your next week of classes at GSU. One balmy Sunday, you awake to find Marty's body stenciled with primitive blue flowers, a blossom on her neck, more on her breasts, an indigo bouquet on the milky plain of her abdomen. You gape at her in groggy wonderment. The woman you plan to marry has become, overnight, an arabesque of disturbing floral bruises. Then you see the cat, Romeo, a neighbor's gray Persian, propped in the corner, belly exposed, so much like a hairy little man in a recliner that you laugh. Marty stirs. Romeo preens. Clearly he entered through a studio window, walked all over Magnolia Heart in blue, then came in here and violated Marty. My wife-to-be is a strip of fond du siècle wallpaper, you muse, kissing her chastely on one of the paw print flowers. You sleep on the streets. You wear the same stinking clothes for days on end. You haven't been on haloperidol for months. The city could be Lima or Istanbul or Bombay, as easy as Atlanta. Hell, it could be a boulder-littered crater on the moon. You drag from one place to another like a zombie, and the people you hit up for hamburgers, change, MARTA tokens, old newspapers, have no more substance to you than you do to them. They could all be holograms or ghosts. They could be androids programmed to keep you dirty and hungry by dictating your behavior with remote control devices that look like wristwatches and keyrings. Cats mean more to you than people do. The people may not be people. Cats are fellow survivors, able to sniff out nitrogenous substances from blocks away. Food. You follow a trio of scrawny felines down Ponce de Leon to the rear door of a catfish restaurant, where the dumpster overflows with greasy paper and other high refuse. The cats strut around on the mounded topography of this debris, while you balance on an upturned trash barrel, mindlessly picking and choosing. Seven rooms away from Coach Osteen's lab, Mr. Petty is teaching advanced junior English, poetry. He stalks around the room like an actor doing Hamlet, even when the poem's Something Dumb by Ogden Nash, or Something Beat and Surface Sacrilegious by Ferlinghetti, or Something Short and Puzzling by Carlos Williams. The Williams piece is about a cat that climbs over a cabinet, a jam closet, and steps into a flower pot. Actually, Mr. Petty says, it's about the image created by Williams's purposely simple diction. Everyone argues that it isn't a poem at all. It's even less a poem, lacking metaphors, than that Carl Sandburg thing about the fog coming on little, for Christ's sake, cat's feet. You like it, though. You can see the cat stepping cautiously into the flower pot. The next time you're in Coach Osteen's class, trying to redeem yourself at the dissection table, you recite the poem for Pamela Van Ryn, Jesse Faye Culver, Kathy Marginal, and Cynthia Spivey. Coach Osteen, shaking his head, makes you repeat the lines so that he can say them too. Amazing.
Cats are digitigrade creatures, he tells a lab. That means they walk on their toes. Digitigrade.
Cynthia Spivey catches your eye. Well, I'll be a pussy willow, she silently mouths. Who'd have thunk it?
Unlike the dog or the horse, Coach Osteen goes on, the cat walks by moving the front and back legs of one side of its body, and then the front and back legs on the other. The only other animals to move that way are the camel and the giraffe.
And naked crazy folks rutting on all fours, you think, studying Cynthia's lips and wondering if there was ever a feral child raised by snow leopards or jaguars. Ty-Ty develops a urinary tract infection. Whenever he has to pee, he looks for Mama pulling weeds or hanging out clothes in the backyard, then squats to show her that he's not getting the job done. It takes Mama 2 or 3 days to realize what's going on. Then you and she carry Ty to the vet. Mama waits tables at a Denny's near the expressway. She hasn't really gotten the money for the operation that Ty needs to clear up the blockage, a common problem in male Siamese. She tells you that you can either forfeit movie money for the next few months or help her pay to make Tai well. You hug Mama, wordlessly agreeing that the only thing to do is to help your cat. The operation goes okay, but the vet telephones a day later to report that Tai took a bad turn overnight and died near morning. Tai's chocolate and silver body has a bandage cinched around his middle, like a wraparound saddle. You're the one who buries Tai because Mama can't bring herself to. You put him in a Siamese-sized cardboard box, dig a hole under the holly in the backyard, and lay him to rest with a spank of the shovel blade and a prayer consisting of grief-stricken repetitions of the word please. 2 or 3 months later, you come home from school to find a pack of dogs in the backyard. They've dug Tai Tai up. You chase the dogs away, screeching from an irate crouch. Tai's corpse is nothing but matted fur and protruding bones. Its most conspicuous feature is the bandage, holding the maggoty skeleton together at its cinched-in waist. This isn't Tai, you tell yourself. I buried Tai a long, long time ago, and this isn't him. You carry the remains, jacketed in the editorial section of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, to a trash can and dump them with an abrupt, indifferent thunk. Pickup is tomorrow. One Sunday afternoon in March, you're standing with 200 other homeless people at the entrance to Trinity United Methodist Soup Kitchen near the state capitol. It's drizzling. A thin but gritty-looking young woman in jeans and sweatshirt, her hair lying in dark strands against her forehead, is passing out hand-numbered tickets to every person who wants to get into the basement. At the head of the outside basement steps is a man in pleated slacks and a plaid shirt. He won't let anyone down the steps until they have a number in the group of 10 currently being admitted. He has to get an okay from the soup kitchen staff downstairs before he'll allow a new group of 10 to pass. Your number, on a green slip of paper already drizzle-dampened, is 126. The last group down held numbers 96 to 105, you think. Hard to tell with all the shoving, cursing, and bantering on the line. One angry black man up front doesn't belong there. He waves his ticket every time a new group of 10 is called, hoping, even though his number is 182, to squeeze past the man set there to keep order.
"How many carrots you'll ring?"
he asks.
"I'm sick. Let me in before I fall out. Damn this here rain."
When the dude holding number 109 doesn't show, the stair guard lets number 182 pass, a good riddance sort of charity. You shuffle up with the next two groups. How many of these people are robots, human machines drawn to the soup kitchen, as you may have been, on invisible tractor beams? The stair guard isn't wearing a watch or shaking a key ring. It's probably his wedding band that's the remote control device.
"My God,"
he cries when he sees you.
"Is that really you?" "It is, isn't it?"
The stair guy's name is Dirk Healy. He says he went to school with you in Hapeville. Remember Pamela Van Ryn? Remember Cynthia what's-her-name? When you go down into the basement and get your two white bread sandwiches and a styrofoam cup of vegetable soup, Dirk convinces another volunteer to take over his job and sits down next to you at one of the rickety folding tables where your fellow street folk are single-mindedly eating. Dirk, who as far as you're concerned could be the man in the moon, doesn't ask how you got in this fix, doesn't accuse, doesn't exhort.
"You're off your medication, aren't you?"
Your hackles lift.
"Hey," he soothes, "I visited you at Quiet Harbor. The thing to do is to get you back on it."
You eat, taking violent snatches of the sandwiches, quick sips of the soup. You one-eyed Dirk over the steam the way that years ago, Sky one-eyed you from her grain crib nest.
"I may have a job for you,"
Dirk says confidently.
"Ever hear of Rockdale Biological?"
One summer, for reasons you don't understand, Mama sends you to visit your father and his ex-hairdresser Floozy, whose name is Carol Grace, in the Florida town where they live off the proceeds of her mail-order business and sometimes bet the dogs at the local greyhound track. Carol Grace may bet the greyhounds at the track, but at home she's a cat person. She owns 7, a marmalade-colored Tom, a piebald Tom, three tricolor females, an orange angora of ambiguous gender, and a Manx mix with a tail 4 or 5 inches long, as if someone shortened it with a cleaver.
If Stubb were pure Manx, Carol Grace says, he wouldn't have no tail. Must have been an alley Tom in his mama's kitty litter.
Stroking Stubb, she chortles happily. She and your mother look a little alike. They have a similar feistiness, too, although it seems coarser in Carol Grace, whom your balding father, she calls him Webby for Pete's sake, unabashedly dotes on. A few days into your visit, Carol Grace and you find one of her females, Hetty Lamar, lying crumpled under a pecan tree, shading the 2-story house's south side. The cat is dead. You kneel to touch her. Carol Grace kneels beside you.
Must have fell, she says. Lots of people think cats are too jack-be-nimble to fall, but they can slip up, too. Guess my Hetty didn't remember that, pretty thing. Now look.
You are grateful that today, Carol Grace does the burying and the prayer saying. Her prayer includes the melancholy observation that anyone can fall. Anyone. Enough of this crap, Penfield says. Tell me what you did, and for whom, and why, at Rockdale Biological. Give him what I can, you mumble, working to turn your head into the uncompromising rigidity of the clamps. Adolf, Penfield says, what you're giving me is cat juggling. Alone in the crafts room with Kim Yawn, while the other kids in Blue Group, QHPC's Wild Child Wing has 2 sections, blue and gold, go on a field trip, you daub acrylics at a crude portrayal of a cat walking upside down on a ceiling. Under the cat, a woman and a teenage boy point and make hateful faces.
Are they angry at the cat or at each other? Kim asks.
You give her a look. What a stupid question. Kim comes over, stands at your shoulder. If she were honest, she'd tell you that you're no artist at all. The painting may be psychologically revealing, but it refutes the notion that you have any talent as a draftsman or a colorist.
Ever hear of British artist Louis Wain? Kim says. He lived with 3 unmarried sisters and a pack of cats. His schizophrenia didn't show up until he was almost 60. That's late.
Lucky, you say. He didn't have so long to be crazy.
Listen now. Wain painted only cats. He must have really liked them. At first, he did smarmy, realistic kitties for calendars and postcards. Popular crap. Later, thinking jealous competitors were zapping him with x-rays or something, the cats in his paintings got weird. Really hostile and menacing.
Weirder than mine. You jab your brush at it.
Ah, that's a mere putty tat.
Then,
in the 15 years he was institutionalized, Wain painted scads of big-eyed, spiky-haired cats. He put bright neon auras and electrical fields around them. His backgrounds got geometrically rad. Today you might think they were computer-generated. Anyhow, Wayne's crazy stuff was better, fiercer, stronger, than the crap he'd done sane.
Meaning I'm a total loss unless I get crazier, you say?
No. What I'm trying to tell you is that the triangles, stars, rainbows, and repeating arabesques that Wain put into his paintings grew from a desperate effort to, well, to impose order on the chaos inside him. It's touching, really touching. Wain was trying to confront and reverse, the only way he could, the disintegration of his adult personality. See?
But you don't. Not exactly. Kim taps your acrylic cat with a burgundy fingernail.
You're not going to be the new Picasso, but you aren't doomed to suffer as terrifying a schizophrenia as Wain suffered either. The bizarre thing in your painting is the cat on the ceiling. The colors and the composition itself are reassuringly conventional. A good sign for your mental health. Another thing is, Wayne's doctors couldn't give him antipsychotic drugs. You, though, have access.
Cheers. You pantomime knocking back a little cup of Haldol. Kim smiles.
So why'd you paint the cat upside down?
Because I'm upside down, you say. Kim gives you a peck on the cheek.
You're not responsible for a gone-awry brain chemistry,
or an unbalanced metabolism, hun. Go easy on yourself, okay?
Dropping your brush, you pull Kim to you and try to nuzzle her under the jaw. Effortlessly, she bends back your hand and pushes you away.
But that, she says, you're going to have to control. Friends, not lovers. Sorry if I gave you the wrong idea. Really. Really.
If the pieces toward the end don't fit, Howie tells you, you can always use a razor blade. He holds one up. You try to take it. Double-edged, it slices your thumb. Some of your blood splatters on the cat puzzle.
A guy in a truck drives up to the specimen prep platform and loading dock behind Rockdale Biological Medical Supply. It's an unmarked panel truck with no windows behind the cab. The guys who drive the truck change, it seems, almost every week. But you're a 2-month fixture on the concrete platform with the slide cages and the euthanasia cabinet. Back here, you're Dirk Healy's main man, especially now that he's off on a business trip somewhere. Your job is both mindless and strength-sapping. The brick wall around the rear of the RBMS complex and the maple trees shielding the loading dock help you keep your head together. Healy has you on a lower dosage of haloperidol than you took while you and Marty were still married. Says you were over-medicated before. Says you were, ha-ha, an apathetic drug slave. He should know. He's been a hotshot in National Medical Supply for years.
We'll have you up in the front office in no time,
he assured you a couple weeks ago.
The platform job's a kind of trial.
The guy in the truck backs up and starts unloading. Dozens of cats in slide cages. You wear elbow-length leather gloves and a heavy apron and feel a bit like an old-timey Western blacksmith. The cats are pieces of scrap iron to be worked in the forge. You slide the door end of each cage into the connector between the open platform and the euthanasia cabinet, then poke the cats in the butt or the flank with a long metal rod until they duck into the cabinet to escape your prodding. When the cabinet's full, you drop the safety door, check the gauges, turn on the gas. It hisses louder than the cats climbing over one another, louder than their yowling and tumbling, which noises gradually subside and finally stop. By hand, you unload the dead cats from the chamber, sliding them out by their tails or their legs. You cease feeling like a blacksmith. You imagine yourself as a 19th-century trapper, stacking fox, beaver, rabbit, wolf, and muskrat pelts on a travois for a trip to the trading post. The pelts are pretty, though many are blemished by vivid skin diseases and a thick black dandruff of gassed fleas. How much could they be worth?
$9.50 a cat, Dirk Healy has said.
That seems unlikely. They're no longer moving. They're no longer, if they ever were, highly lustrous. They're floppy, anonymous, and dead. Their fur contaminated by a lethal gas. A heavy-duty wheelbarrow rests beside the pile of cats on the platform. You unwind a hose and fill the barrel with water. Dirk has ordered you to submerge the gassed cats to make certain they're dead. Smart. Some of the cats are plucky boogers. They'll mew at you or swim feebly in the cat pile even before you pick them up and sling them into the wheelbarrow. The water in the wheelbarrow ends it, indisputably. It also washes away fleas and the worst aspects of feline scabies. You pull a folding chair over and sort through the cats for the ones with flea collars, ID collars, rabies tags. You take these things off. You do it with your gloves on, a sodden cat corpse hammocked in your apron. It's not easy, given your wet glove fingers. If it's sunny, you take the dead cats to the bright part of the platform and lay them out in neat rows to dry.
Can't you get him to stop mumbling? Penfield asks someone in the room. His testimony's almost unintelligible.
He's replaying the experience inwardly, an indistinct figure says. But he's starting to go autistic on us. Look, Penfield says, we've got to get him to verbalize clearly, or we've wasted our time. 2 months after the divorce, you drive to Spartanburg, to the Bragg's house to see Jacob. Mr. Bragg, Howie, intercepts you at the front gate, as if appraised of your arrival by surveillance equipment.
I'm sorry, he says, but Marty doesn't want to see you. and she doesn't want you to see Jake. If you don't leave, I'll have to call the police to, you know, remove you. You don't contest this. You walk across the road to your car. From there, you can see that atop the brick post on either side of Mr. Bragg's ornate gate reposes a roaring granite lion. You can't remember seeing these lions before, but the crazed and reticulated state of the granite suggests they've been there a while. It's a puzzle. As you lay out the dead cats, you assign them names. The names you assign are always Mehitabel, Felix, Sylvester, Tom, Heathcliff, Garfield, and Bill. These seven names must serve for all the cats on the platform. Consequently, you add Roman numerals to the names when you run out of names before you do cats. Mehitabel 2, Felix 2, Sylvester Tom 2, and so on. It's a neat, workable system. Once, you cycled all the way to Sylvester 7 before running out of specimens. As a fifth grader in Nota Solga, you sit and watch a film about the American space program. An old film clip shows a cat, really more a kitten than a cat, suspended from a low ceiling by its feet. It's a metal ceiling, and the scientist who devised the experiment, which has something to do with studying the kitten's reactions to upside-downness, then applying these findings to astronauts aboard a space station, has fastened magnets to the cat's feet so that they will adhere to the metal surface. The scientist has also rigged up a pair of mice in the same odd way to see if they will distract, entice, or frighten the hanging kitten. They don't. The kitten is terrified, not of the mice, who seem to be torpid and unimaginative representatives of their kind, but of the alien condition in which it finds itself. Insofar as it is able, the kitten lurches against the magnets, its ears back, its mouth wide open in a silent cry. On the soundtrack, a male voice explains the import and usefulness of this experiment. No one can hear him, though, because most of the other kids in Miss Beischer's class are laughing uproariously at the kitten. You look around in a kind of sick stupefaction. Millie Heckler, Angus Lee Terrence, and a few other girls appear to be as appalled as you, but the scene doesn't last long. It's probably shorter than your slow-motion memory of it, and it seems for a moment that you are that kitten, that everything in the world has been wretchingly upended. I know it seemed to you that evil people were trying to invade and control your thoughts, Dr. Hall, the director of Quiet Harbor, tells you. He pets a neutered male just back from a visit to the gerontological wing. But that was just a symptom of the scrambled condition of your brain chemistry. The truth is... Fatigued, you slouch out the rear gate of Rockdale Biological. Your apartment, the three-roomer that Healy provided, is only a short distance away. A late-model Lincoln Town Car pulls alongside you as you walk the weed-grown sidewalk. The tinted window on the front seat passenger side powers down, and you catch your first glimpse of the raw-complexioned man who introduces himself as David Penfield. An alias? Why do you think so? If you like, he says, think of me as the zoo cop. It's a permission you don't really want. Why would you choose to think of a well-dressed, ordinary-featured man with visible acne scarring as something as déclassé as Jesus the zoo cop? Is he a detective of some sort? What does he want? The next thing you know, you're in the car with Penfield and two other tight-lipped men. The next thing you know, you're on the expressway, and one of the zoo cop's associates, goons, has locked the suction cup feet of one of those corny Garfield toys on his tinted window as a kind of, what, mockery? Rebuke? Warning? The next thing you know, you're in a basement that clearly isn't the soup kitchen of Trinity United Methodist. The next thing you know, you're flat on your back on the table. The next thing you know, you don't know anything. Marty's body is stenciled with primitive blue flowers, a blossom on her neck, more on her breasts, an indigo bouquet on the milky plane of her abdomen. You gaze at her in groggy wonderment. The woman you one day marry has become, overnight, an arabesque of disturbing floral bruises. Marty, you whisper. Marty, don't leave me.
Marty, don't take my son away.
Penfield, a.k.a. the zoo cop, you realize during your descent into the puzzle box, isn't a real cop. He hates you because what you've been doing for Healy is vile, contemptible evil. So it is. So it is. He wants to get Healy, who hasn't been around this last week at all, who's maybe skipped off to Barbados or the Yucatan or St. Tropez. Penfield is an animal rights eco-terrorist, well-financed and determined, and the ESB zappings to which he and his associates are subjecting you are designed to incriminate, pinpoint, and doom old Dirk and his associates, who obviously deserve it. You too. You deserve it too. No argument there. None. Christ, Penfield says. Unhook the son of a bitch and carry him upstairs. Dump him somewhere remote. Somewhere rural. You visit the pound for a replacement for Springer and Aussie, gassed 3 or 4 years ago. The attendant tells you there are plenty of potential adoptees at the shelter. You go down the rows of cages to select one. The kittens in the fouled sawdust tumble, paw and meow, putting on the dispirited show. This one, you finally say.
Cute,
the attendant approves. Well, they'd fire her if she didn't. The idea is to adopt these creatures out, not to let them lapse into expendability. It's for Jake, my son, you tell her. His asthma isn't that bad. I think he may be growing out of it.
Look at my puzzle, Howie says, yanking the razor blade away from you. You've bled all over it.
For Gene